This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Flashpoints, we'll take an in-depth look at the stimulus and bailout package as Obama takes his economic roadshow to Phoenix. First, we'll speak with our regular Wednesday guest for community business, Catherine Austin Fitz, and then we'll be joined by Stephen Pizzo, author of the best-selling book Inside Job, The Looting of America's Savings and Loan. Also, we'll hear about the Bush Project, a new grassroots movement to hold the Bush administration accountable for war crimes. We'll speak with veteran Middle East journalist and radio producer Jeff Blankford about the expanding power of AIPAC, that's the Israeli lobby, and we'll have the night report. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoint. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and now we go to New York City, where we have the Night Report in Exile with Robert Knight.
In today's Night Report and War Summary, President Obama increases the U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan by one half, with 18,000 more troops due over the next 3 months. I'm Robert Knight in New York. 35,000 more American boots will soon be landing in Afghanistan, escalating the U.S. presence there by 17,500 troops and increasing the current presence of 30,000 by 50%. Obama blamed the escalation on tribal militias near the Khyber Pass, saying in a statement that, quote, "The Taliban is resurgent in Afghanistan and al-Qaeda supports the insurgency and threatens America from its safe haven along the Pakistani border," end quote. The administration insisted today that the de facto deployment would not predetermine a regional policy analysis due in 6 weeks. The additional troops are scheduled to arrive by May, just in time for the annual cycle of increased guerrilla combat during the spring thaw. However, it appears that deployment will also have an ulterior purpose in southern Afghanistan. The American troops are expected to engage local farmers who grow poppies for heroin cultivation, a practice that has mushroomed in the 8 years since the U.S. and NATO overthrew Taliban fundamentalists who had officially banned the opiate trade under their Islamic regime. Further south in Pakistan, the Taliban has secured a peace agreement with the government in hopes of ending army shelling of militia positions in the Swat Valley tribal region. Pakistani People's Party parliamentarian Syed Al-Adeen says that the recent military attacks on the Tehrik-e-Taliban, quote, have been proven useless and fruitless. Before the occupation, he said, the Taliban was in control of 25% of Swat. Now they control 75%, end quote. But regional peace remains elusive because of the continuing U.S. drone and missile attacks launched from Afghanistan against so-called militants in northwestern Pakistan. Today, the latest confirmation of Pakistan's covert cooperation in that publicly protested policy comes from the London Times, which is reporting that the CIA is secretly using the Shamsi airfield in the Balochistan province to launch predator drones from southern Pakistan against alleged al-Qaeda and Taliban militants in the northwest. The Times uncovered Pentagon records revealing the delivery of more than $3 million worth of aviation fuel to the drone launch site. A U.S. embassy official issued the following denial of the covert cooperation, and here we quote, "No, no, 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 no. We unequivocally and emphatically can tell you there is no basing of U.S. troops in Pakistan. There is no basing of U.S. Air Force, Navy, Marines, Army, none on the record and emphatically. I want to be very clear, and that is the answer any way you want to put it. There is no base here, no troops billeted. We do not operate here," end quote. Significantly, that State Department spokesperson omitted any reference to Central Intelligence Agency operations at the Shamsi base. However, one undeniable fact is the continued killing of Pakistani civilians under the Predator program. The latest strike on Monday killed 31 residents of the tribal agency of Karam, and another on Saturday killed 25 more in South Waziristan. Overall, 2,120 innocent Pakistani civilians were killed last year, half of them victims of U.S. airstrikes. That represents a 40% increase over 2007, according to the United Nations mission in Afghanistan. However, NATO insists that only half that number of civilians, 973, were killed last year, while the Kabul-based Afghanistan Rights Monitor places the number closer to 4,000. In any case, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights notes that 2008 marks, quote, the highest civilian death toll of any year since the fall of the Taliban regime at the end of 2001, end quote. And finally, in the other regional theater of war, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction is reporting the disappearance of between $50 and $125 billion of U.S. military aid and reconstruction funds. That makes the Iraq War an even more lucrative source of embezzlement than the Wall Street Ponzi scheme of Bernard Madoff. And that's some of the news of this Wednesday, February 18th, 2009. From Exile in New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoint.
Thank you, Robert. This is Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. President Barack Obama took his economic roadshow to Phoenix today to announce his long-awaited plan to take on the U.S. housing meltdown. He said that the creation of a $75 billion fund will be a part of a project to help some 9 million responsible homeowners from defaulting on their homes. Today's announcement came a day after Obama signed the $787 billion economic stimulus package. Joining us for a deep analysis on the nuts and bolts of the stimulus and the bailout is Catherine Austin Fitz with our weekly edition of Community Business. Catherine is our translator from Wall Street to Main Street. Catherine, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Oh, it's good to be back. It's good to be back. I bet California's happy the stimulus package passed.
I can even hear him through the soundproof studio cheering. Everybody is feeling a lot better now. These were sort of, if you will, an exciting, if confusing and troubling 2 days for economic journalists and a lot of economic news. On the one hand, the stimulus. Today he's in Phoenix with he's going to save a whole bunch of people who are about to default. Your analysis on what you've seen, what's happened here in the last 2 days?
What we've done is we've pumped significant cash flow, and if my read of the stimulus package is right, Dennis, we've pumped tremendous cash flow into state and local government. We had, and California was the leader of this, we were really watching a meltdown. What you see is tremendous mandated programs by the federal government and then by the state down to local governments, and when the cash flows dry up, and of course state and local governments are in big deficit positions right now, but when the cash flows dry up, of course the Fed can keep deficit financing, but the state and local governments by law cannot, and so the tensions grow, and we were watching counties in California threaten to shut off the money that they owe to the state, so stop the cash flows going back, or even sue the state. So we were really watching a fundamental breakdown. My read of the stimulus package is it's going to delay the problem by about, you know, through maybe October or November, if we're lucky, because the fundamental problems in the economy and in state and local government are still there. We're going to come through the tax dates in March and April. A lot of states and local government are going to have to balance their budgets as of June 30. At the same time, the Congress is going to be working on the new budget for October 1st. And I just think we're going to see incredible pain. There was an article today in the Wall Street Journal, a lawyer whose expertise is advising companies on layoffs, said if just the layoffs he's being asked to help with translate into, you know, sort of the normal percentage of real layoffs. We're looking at significant more layoffs. He's just dealing with corporations, I'm assuming. If you look at what state and local governments are going to have to do to balance their budget, we're still coming in. You know, the stimulus package has pushed out the problem, but the problem is growing.
And in terms of the nuts and bolts of this, $787 billion, that's a figure that most people can't even imagine. How does this work? How do 3 million or 4 million people get their jobs in this context?
Well, if you look at the money, you've got a variety of different funding. And up at my blog at solari.com/blog, I have a list of the items this is going to. So, for example, you have $40 billion to extend unemployment benefits and increase them by $25 a week. You've got funding for food stamps, funding for temporary welfare payments. So these are all programs that are ongoing, and what you're simply doing is making sure as they grow that the money is there to deal with the growth of people who are eligible for example, unemployment benefits and food stamps. You've got a significant money going into transportation, and that kind of construction should create jobs. I haven't seen how they count the jobs. But if you look at the list that's up on the blog, you'll see there's all sorts of money that's going to go out immediately in currently existing programs. It's just going to, for example, we were looking at places in unemployment compensation when, you know, there just wasn't the money to pay it. So you have construction, you have school construction, you have some energy programs, you have transportation, so it's going to go out across the board. But again, the important thing to understand is that providing this kind of cash can keep things going in the short term, but there's real change that has to happen in the long term. We have to go back to being productive economically. If we should stop, God forbid, being the reserve currency worldwide, we're going to have to do that even faster. And these kinds of stimulus packages can just delay the time when that has to happen. And so it gives every listener and every household time to really start to change and make those changes in our own lives that will help us, because this kind of cash flow is not going to last forever.
He's already talking about a new another stimulus package. Is that
well, no, because let's look at what's really going on. The stimulus package was $700 billion plus. So far, this comes with the administration saying they're going to provide another approximately $2.2 trillion, which is, you know, three times that amount, for additional authorization of loans and bailouts for banks, which brings the bailout amount up to over $10 trillion to date, authorized between the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. And, you know, to be blunt, that's, you know, so the stimulus package is nothing compared to the money that's being provided for the banks, and at the same time as this passage is, you know, has passed. So the message from the administration is, you know, we're basically taking the lion's share of the remaining federal credit and dedicating it to the banks, not to the people.
Now, it's, did you say $10
trillion? $10
trillion. So $10 trillion to bail out the banks and $787 billion to bail out everybody else.
Well, not to bail out everybody else, to keep everybody else going for 6 more months.
Right. It's like, yes. Okay. We're speaking with Catherine Austin Fitz. This is our weekly edition of Community Business. And let's go, you know, this is sort of the bailout side of the stimulus package. You say unless we become more productive. Remind people what you mean by that.
Okay, when I worked at HUD as the Assistant Secretary of Housing, and then after I left in the Clinton administration, my company got hired back to be lead financial advisor. And in both instances, both in the Bush and Clinton administration, I found communities where HUD was spending $250,000 per unit on public housing. And I should note that there's $4 billion for public housing improvements in the stimulus package. We were paying $250,000 per unit for public housing when $50,000 would buy and rehab a single family home in a 4 or 5 block area. And so we were spending 4 to 5 times per unit what we needed to do. And I'll never forget, I went to the assistant to the person running the program during the Clinton administration, and I said, look, Mindy, you know, we could, you know, I was showing her New Orleans, we could buy and rehab 5 single family homes for the price of 1 public housing, I think it was Hope 6 project, you know, why don't we do this? And she looked at me, turned bright red, and said, but how would we generate fees for our friends? And if you go through all the government spending and create, map out the government money, sort of sources and uses of federal money by local area, what you'll discover is that we've had 50 years of fees for our friends and that there's been no optimization around real productivity to the citizenry. Instead, we're trying to buy off a series of different political interests, and more often than not, it's big corporations or black budget stuff. And all of that, I mean, that's what created the train tracks for all this mortgage fraud. So we have never put government spending and credit to the standard of how do we get the most wonderful place. And until you do that, you're going to see huge amounts of money being pumped out for the point, you know, to achieve centralized control and to pump up a lot of big companies and banks. But it's not productive.
And now we just have a few minutes left. In terms of the very brief summary of where is the bailout now, what's happening on the bailout front?
Well, here's where the bailout is now. The bailout, we've got a series of very big banks, and the belief, or we're being told, you know, financial shock and awe, we're being told that the $10 trillion is not enough, and that we're going to need to nationalize the big banks. And so we had Greenspan yesterday saying we really need to do a selective nationalization of the big banks. Now, that's a simple world, but it umbrellas many different forms or concepts, and the idea being that we would take on, the taxpayers would take on 100% liability for whatever is in the derivatives and other portfolios of the very biggest banks. Now, you know, my comment to all of this is, if we nationalize anything, we ought to nationalize the Federal Reserve, because you know, the time has come for the people that the people elect to have oversight and control over the Federal Reserve, and not to have our depository and payment systems run by private bankers.
All right. Now, finally, let us talk about where taxes are going these days, as in who's in charge. And by the way, what is Carlyle, the Carlyle Group, have to do with this? And before you tell us that, give us a two-liner on who Carlyle is.
Well, Carlyle is a private equity firm that was created at the end of the Iran-Contra period by, in fact, some of the people involved in the Iran-Contra period. But basically, some private bankers and government officials created this private equity firm in Washington. And in financial terms, it's been unbelievably successful. The understanding is it's because of their ability to manipulate private capital in ways that then perform well because they have the government influence to arrange the contracts or rules or whatever. So it's a very Washington Wall Street incestuous company, and it's gotten a fair amount of headlines because of the notoriety of some of the deals and some of the people who've gone to work there.
All right, and what are they doing now?
Well, now they're raising cash to buy and help recapitalize banks. The new Secretary of the Treasury has made it very clear that what he'd like to do in this financial stability plan is allow private investors to come in and buy, take toxic assets off of the bank's balance sheets or recapitalize the banks. And what has been proposed, Dennis, is a format where there'll be certain guarantees, so any losses above a certain amount could be put to the taxpayers. Now, so far, the details have been somewhat vague, but the implications is we're going to have the same kind of unbelievable profits by the private sector. The same guys who basically engineered the problems are going to make a fortune, quote, cleaning them up, and the bill's going to get stuck to the taxpayers, which is exactly what we saw in 1989. I mean, I'll never forget on the first RTC bids on the SNL cleanup in 1989, realizing, oh, my word, you know, these guys sold at 10 times market, and they're buying back in at 10% of market. You know, this is the ultimate pump and dump. So, you know, what you're watching is pretty ugly, and the only way to avoid it is to face the music and start to institute real change. And frankly, you know, let's not wait for the pro-centralization team to do it. We're going to have to do it ourselves.
Now, finally, very briefly, though, you know, here we're broadcasting, as you know, from Berkeley, California, the land of earthquakes. I'm told by one of our guests that we're going to have on later that there actually was a bit of a tremor up north as we were speaking just before we went on the air. And here
they're
starting
to make me believe the rumors of HAARP.
But here, you know, we have a lot of earthquake preparation, and they tell you to get your special kit, you know, your flashlight and your transistor radio, if that's what they still are. But what's just basically for people who are struggling, people who are afraid, people who have already lost money in these funds, teachers, nurses, what's in the emergency kit for them?
Well, the first great emergency kit is family and community. And I think the most important thing is not, you know, is not what we need is money. It's time. We need to take the time to start talking to each other and understanding what we can do to help each other ease the pain. There is so much we can do, Dennis, in terms of trading time or in helping each other sort of see what's going on and avoid the mistakes and put as many degrees of separation between yourself and unreliable systems. And frankly, my attitude is if it's a large bank or corporation, it's guilty until proven innocent. So it's pretty simple to figure out how to put as many degrees of separation between you and the large guys. And now the issue is, can you start to build alliances around practical issues of food, water, shelter, clothing, and do it in a way that radically reduces your overhead, and if you can, brings down your debt.
All right, Catherine Austin Fitz, Community Business every Wednesday on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. As always, Catherine, it is a pleasure, and we will talk to you next week.
Have a great evening, Dennis.
All right, bye-bye. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And we're going to continue the discussion on the economic stimulus and focus again on Obama's plan to rescue homeowners. Joining us now is Stephen Pizzo. Pizzo is the co-author of the best-selling book Inside Job, The Looting of America's Savings and Loans. The book became really the Bible for those of us who were trying to understand the ins and outs and nuances of the SNL meltdown after deregulation. Pizzo is also the editor of The Real News blog at www.therealnews.com.
Newsforreal.com.
All right. Dyslexia. I am a devout dyslexic, I assure you, Mr. Pizzo. But it is good to have you on Flashpoints. It's been a long time, and we do want to talk to you in one moment about the Bush Project. But let me just read a little bit from your blog here, News for Real. Let me read a little bit what you write here under the title of the Federal Bank of Chernobyl. I have sympathy for Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner as I listen to him unveil the latest iteration of the bank rescue plan. This morning, an image flashed into my head. It was the image of Soviet troops dropped by helicopter onto the smoking roof of Chernobyl reactor, furiously dumping ton after ton of sand onto the modern reactor below.
Well, now you're saying that he's running into the same problems of as those Soviet troops. We saw Obama. He's in Phoenix today. He's got a plan to rescue 9 million homeowners facing default. A little deja vu with subprime. And what's going through your mind? What are you thinking about all this, Steve Pisa?
Well, you know, boy, I tell you, this makes the SNL fiasco, which you and I were both deeply involved in covering, look like just a hiccup. The problem here, and I'm going to get around to addressing in this what I'm about to say, the home rescue thing too, because you're trying to figure out whether this is a good idea or a bad idea, or whether you're trying to save the banks is a good idea or a bad idea. You know, people don't understand that we've come to understand that the physical world, what we call the ecology, it has all these systems and subsystems, and they're interdependent, sometimes a lot, sometimes a little, and you can have a collapse in the physical environment, say all the polar bears die. But the basic system stays up and running. But if there's too much stress on the system, if the system has been just too abused, then you have a systemic collapse, and the whole thing goes down. Everything goes down. And that's what's happened here with the world economy. Over the last 10 years or so, we removed the key element from capitalism. Now, we can argue about whether capitalism is a good idea or a bad idea, or socialism better. But you know, whatever system you have, they have some core rule. Socialism does too. And when that core rule is violated, the system begins to stress, and if it's violated for too long, it collapses. And what we lost over the last 10 years, in one word, is risk. When you remove risk, is the key element in capitalism's secret sauce. If you remove risk, then it's Katie bar the door, because risk is the regulator on the engine of capitalism that keeps it from running away. If a person or a company or an investment firm faces the very real risk of losing money, it moderates their behavior. They hold back. They don't abuse the system. But what we've done here, what we did over the last 10 years, you take the subprime loans and what. Well, the bank could make a loan to somebody who didn't qualify for too much money. The old days, they kept that on their books. But now they can sell it to some. They can pass that burn on to Wall Street. And then Wall Street can take that that turd and repackage it and shine it up and sell it to investors, thereby removing their risk. And so, and then, of course, we know what happened with all of that. And what's happened now, to get back to Obama and the bailout, is that we are reinforcing, even to a greater degree, the idea that if you create a mess, if you're going to create a financial mess, create a big one. Because if you create a little one, we're going to let you fail. But if you create one hell of a mess, then we're going to remove your risk again, and we're going to come in and bail you out. Now, you know, what about the home price thing today? Well, you know, the home loan renegotiation. Well, look, I mean, we have a systemic collapse going on. And these guys in Washington are throwing everything they can against the wall to see what will stick. I don't blame them for this. I don't think it's going to work, but they're doing whatever they can. The Fed has already lowered the interest rates to effectively zero, so they don't have that tool anymore. The tax cuts, I was just reading an article a few minutes ago about the tax cuts. You know, Republicans want tax cuts. Tax cuts can actually exasperate a deflationary environment. Now, if you think inflation's bad, America's never lived through a real deflationary environment. Deflation is, ironically, far, far worse, because it feeds on itself and it is almost impossible to stop once you start it. And so, you know, there we are. We have a systemic collapse in our hands. Nobody has either the knowledge or the tools to do a damn thing about it. We're on for the ride.
And so when they talk about a stimulus package of whatever they're talking about today, $75 billion, again, this is all guesswork. There is really, they can't say, when they say we're going to help 9 million homeowners, we're going to help them not default, essentially they're making this up as they're going along.
Oh, absolutely. And as far as the banks go, I mean, the right thing to do, and a far less expensive thing to do, would be to look at the banks that are in trouble, put them in federal receivership, in essence, nationalize them. Now, everybody freaks out with that word because, you know, they start screaming socialism. And God forbid, you know, here we are. God forbid that America should be socialistic. I mean, we're already subsidizing more industries than the former Soviet Union ever dreamed of subsidizing, you know, these trillions of dollars of bailout money we're throwing into these industries. But go ahead and put these the troubled banks in receivership. Once you're inside, work out the bad assets, the banks that can be saved and cleaned up, you put them back on the market later and try to sell them to some good people and put them back into the private sector. The ones that can't, you take them out behind the barn, you shoot them. Now, that's the simplest way to do it and the cheapest.
Now, you shoot the banks, but not the people in the banks. Right?
Well, see, that's another problem. You know, they got this whole thing called too big to fail. You know, some of these institutions like Merrill Lynch and some of these other are too big to fail. We can't let them fail. Well, isn't it ironic that you look at anything that they've called too big to fail, that they've had to rescue, and they also seem to be too big to jail? Yeah, apparently, as I said before, if you're going to create a mess, create one hell of a mess.
Now, Bruno, I was amazed to see, is Madoff in jail yet, or he's still in his four-story townhouse?
Oh, no, he's still up there, yeah. it really makes you understand the motivation behind the French Revolution, doesn't it?
You know, I think there's a candy store in that building where he lives, and I bet you if some kid walked in there and he got nailed for stealing a candy bar, he'd probably be taken into custody and at least spend the night in jail.
Yeah. No, I actually toyed with the idea when I heard the Madoff story of starting another website, a blog entitled Get a Rope. And it would be one story like that every day. Just get a rope!
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're talking to Stephen Pizzo. We have been talking about what happened today in Phoenix around the attempt to bail out some of the millions and millions of people who are facing horrifying situations, losing their houses, losing everything. And I was amazed, by the way. We had Catherine Austin Fitz. We do this regular economic community business show every Wednesday. She was saying that her estimate is that they spent about $10 trillion to bail out the banks and $787 billion for the people. That's an interesting proportion.
Well, you know, there's a prima facie proof that the credit card companies and banks knew this was coming years ago. And that proof is the fact that they got the bankruptcy law changed so that people can no longer wipe out their debts, but now are effectively indentured to the credit card companies for the rest of their lives. Now, that's the next thing that's got to be changed. The Obama administration's got to go back in there now and rewrite that bankruptcy law. And guess who was one of the biggest supporters of that law? Our Vice President, Joe Biden, because he's from Delaware, which is where all the credit card companies are. So,
well, that works out really well. You're listening to Flashpoints. Listen, I want to talk to you about the Bush Project. That's a very sort of nice, simple, clear name. But let's get into it this way. And I know you're a pretty smart guy. So you tell me, Steve Pizzo, what do former President Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, former Undersecretary of Defense Wolfowitz, former Undersecretary of Defense Douglas Fife, former VP Chief of Staff David Addington, and a whole bunch of others have in common?
It's a deck of cards, ain't it? Yeah. The list, where do you begin? I started the Bush Project site because it was just a burr under my saddle that these guys were allowed to walk out of Washington and go back into the private sector. And when George Bush asked what he was going to do after he left the White House, he said, "I'm going to go out and give some speeches and refill the old coffers." Those were his exact words. Well, you know, these people were criminals. The proof of the evidence of their crimes is piled up like cordwood everywhere you look. I mean, it's not going to take the world's best prosecutor to take just close his or her eyes, pick one of these things, whether it's torture or whether it's the politicization of the Justice Department, just or the wiretapping, just pick one and take it in front of a grand jury and see what happens. So we started the Bush Project to have a website that could sort of be a central place where I could post resources, how to do a FOIA, databases on international crime and the international court and how those things are pursued. And look, I understand that the Obama people don't want to start this because as soon as they do, it's going to be one hell of a storm, a political storm, and they just don't need it right now. I have a little sympathy there. So we're going to drive this from the bottom up. And if we can get, for example, Vince Bugliosi's book, Prosecution of George Bush for Murder. Now, you know, here's a guy, first of all, who knows what he's talking about when it comes to law. And it's an interesting concept that if a district attorney in Berkeley or in Sonoma County has anybody in their district who'd been killed in the war, he has a jurisdiction to bring a case against George Bush et al. for murder. So if we could get, you know, there's 2,200 district attorneys around the country who received a copy of Vince's book, thanks to a fellow up in Seattle, Bob Alexander, who raised the money and mailed a copy to every district attorney in the United States.
2,200 copies, he said.
2,200 copies. He raised $17,000.
That's the prosecution of George W. Bush for murder. That's what
right.
It's called.
And so let's say out of 2,200 district attorneys, we get 100 of them. You know, two in each state who say, I'm going to take a bite of this apple, goes, takes that thing to a grand jury, and the old saying is, you can indict a ham sandwich before a grand jury. And they get an indictment. That means that these people are going to be put under virtual house arrest. They can't just go fly to Missouri to give a speech for $2 million because, you know, a few months ago, Don Rumsfeld was in Paris to give a speech for pay, and his security detail rushed in and hustled him out of there because a local prosecutor was coming over to arrest him. Now that, you know, so there's a start. There's a start right there. Whether the U.S. Justice Department does anything about it or not, it troubles me greatly. I just don't know if they're going to be willing to bite into this, because if Washington hates anything, it's prosecuting one of their own, even if it's in the other party, because they look at that guy or that gal and they say, whew, there but for the grace of God could be me.
Let me jump in here, Steve Pizzo, and tell people that if they want to investigate more about this, they can go to bushproject.com, and of course they can find more information about this on your website, your blog site. Let me give your website correctly now, newsforreal.com, newsforreal.com, the Bush Project again at bushproject.com. And I guess the concept here is that it would be impossible if enough of these district attorneys jumped in for these people to move around easily to give those speeches. That's the point, right?
We'd be putting them under house arrest, in a sense. You know, it's unlikely, for example, that Texas is going to do anything, so Georgia just have to stay in Texas, which is fine with me. You should have stayed there to begin with.
Well, now, and it is interesting that there is a great interest within the population for this kind of investigation. And you point out on your blog, I guess yesterday, that the information keeps coming, that the ACLU just released some very interesting documents that they got a hold of.
Don Rumsfeld, this is a PDF file that's available online. I have a link to it on the site. That informed Don Rumsfeld, it's addressed to him, he received it, and he read it. And it informed him that his people at one of these secret prisons over at Bagram Air Base had not only beaten detainees, but had beaten two of them to death. Now, you know, if some enemy had done that to one of our troops, what Don Rumsfeld and Bush would have said, they would have been screaming war crimes and Geneva Convention on top of it. So he was informed of this. He did nothing about it. Now, under a federal law. That's called misprison of a felony. You might remember that term because the Republicans brought it up when they went after Webb Hubble, that he did not report what was going on at the Rose Law Firm, blah, blah. So it was a misprison of a felony. And you've got to know that more than Don Rumsfeld saw that memo. You got to know Dick Cheney saw it. You got to know Scooter Libby saw it. You got to know Doug Fife saw it. So these people are guilty of that too, misprison of felony, which by the way is a felony.
Now, when and of course, you know, and for a federal official to know that criminal activity, that a crime has been committed, particularly across international lines, is a major felony that goes along with the office, so it's intensified by the fact that you are in public office. These are very, very serious crimes. And so I guess the idea is to continue to gather the information as it mounts, make it available, I guess, along with these 2,200 books. Any responses yet?
You know, the problem with it, not as much as one would think, considering that this is worse than Watergate by a lot, worse than Iran-Contra. But the mainstream media, which I used to be a part, you know, they just don't seem they write this off as the loony left. The Republicans now have a campaign out. You know, you know what we're suffering from? We have a disease. I don't know if you knew this. It's called Bush Derangement Syndrome. That those of us who want to the prosecution of the former administration are suffering from Bush derangement syndrome. So you've got that whole sort of thing out there that kind of gets mixed up with the 9/11 conspiracy people and all this kind of stuff. And the mainstream press just looks at it and says, oh, my God, there they go again. And so, no, I haven't gotten the kind of response. But we've got to keep the pressure on. The pressure will make a difference. 71% of the American people want to see the Bush administration investigated. That's
71,
a lot of people, and that's more people that voted
wow.
for Obama.
Wow. Well, interesting. Stephen Pizzo, it's if you want more interest, more information on the Bush Project, go to bushproject.com. Check out Stephen Pizzo's blog, newsforreal.com, his website. Get you to his writing. Very interesting stuff you got up there, Steve Pizzo. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints. We're going to come back and keep this dialogue open on this.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
You take it easy. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Coming up on a moment, we will be talking with a journalist about the very powerful Israeli lobby known as AIPAC. Stay with us. listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Neil Young here, making music for us via CD. In Berkeley, as I said, I'm Dennis Bernstein, and we continue our reporting on the situation in the Middle East, Israel, the occupation of Palestine. But today we take a look at AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, also known as the Israeli Lobby. It's the second most powerful lobbying organization on Capitol Hill. The extremely well-funded Israeli Lobby has tentacles deep into the offices of key political players in Washington, and that includes the White House. Within 12 hours of Obama's win of the Democratic nomination, he was, yes, groveling at a breakfast event held by AIPAC in Washington, D.C. It was his first meeting in his run for the presidency. Joining us to talk about the Obama administration, how they'll deal with AIPAC and their policies on Israel and Palestine is seasoned Middle East journalist and public radio host Jeffrey Blankford. Jeff, welcome back to Flashpoint.
Nice to be on the show again, Dennis. I know you're doing great work in reporting from Gaza.
Well, thank you. Of course, you have been in this story for a very long time. And just to set the scene, just take a minute and remind people. I mean, you have taken on the Israeli Lobby and their advocates at a lot of different levels. Remind people what happened to you.
Well, first, I wanted to correct something. They say that AIPAC is the second most powerful lobby after ARP, the American Association of Retired Persons. But as somewhat retired person, you could ask most people, elderly persons who belong to ARP, old people in this country are treated worse than in any other developed country. So that lobby doesn't do very much for old people. But getting back to my own situation, back in 1987, Steve Zeltzer and myself formed something called the Labor Committee on the Middle East, and we were infiltrated by someone who turned out to be an agent for the Anti-Defamation League, their leading fact finder, a spy named Roy Bullock. And we found out that he was actually been a spy for 25 years, being paid as a cutout. And later, when it turned out that the FBI found out that the ADL was spying on the Nation of Islam, we made the connections to the newspapers, to the SF Examiner, that there was a connection between that and the spy on us. And it turned out that spy had also been spying on South African exiles and anti-apartheid movement for the government of South Africa while he was spying for the ADL. Something the ADL never apologized for. But we had a long.
The ADL is sponsored by B'nai B'rith.
It used to be. The ADL was founded, Anti-Defamation League was founded in 1913 by the large Jewish organization B'nai B'rith as a defense for Jews after the hanging of Leo Frank in the South for a charge, a murder charge that was questioned at the time. In recent years, it has become independent of B'nai B'rith and is much more important than B'nai B'rith, which has kind of shrunk into the shadows. The ADL, along with AIPAC and the American Jewish Committee, are the most powerful organizations in the Jewish committee, in the Jewish community.
Now tell us, give us the infrastructure of AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. Tell us how they work, what kind of structure do they use?
It has about 150,000 members across the country, about a $50 million budget. They, in Washington, they have a huge building. Because they have gotten away with not having to register as a foreign lobby, AIPAC staff member sits in the committee meetings of every committee that has anything to do with the Middle East or Israel. They write speeches for congressmen, members of the House and Senate. They make these talking points, but they also draft legislation, such as the legislation that Congress voted on, the House voted on January 9th and the Senate on the 7th, which gave unquestioned support for Israel for its war on Gaza. It's vigorous, I could quote, it's vigorous support and unwavering commitment to the welfare, security, and survival of the State of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state with secure borders, and recognizes its right to act in self-defense to protect its citizens against Hamas's unceasing aggression as enshrined in the UN Charter.
Now, what happens to a U.S. politician who takes on Israel?
If you simply vote against foreign aid and say nothing, nothing happens to you generally. If you speak out on the floor of the House or the Senate, as Senator Fulbright, the famous Senator Fulbright did, as Senator Adlai Stevenson Jr. did, as Charles Percy did, Paul Finley, Congressman Pete McCloskey, Cynthia McKinney, Earl Hilliard, Gus Savage, Charles Haynes, Mervyn Diamond, these are members of the Black Caucus, the last five, they go after you if you are at all vulnerable.
They go after you? What does that mean?
What it means is you will find that you will have an opponent running against you who is well-funded, or they will find an opponent to run against you, and that opponent will then receive money from Jewish supporters of Israel from across the country.
So they will try and get rid of you and have been very effective in that regard.
Pardon?
They will try and get rid of you electorally and have been very effective.
Yes, and as one pro-Israel congressman told Morton Kondracki, quoted in the New Republic in 1989, it's not out of love for Israel that there's no debate on aid to Israel, but you don't want to wake up the next morning having an opponent with a $500,000 war chest to run against you. So what's important about AIPAC, they don't give money to politicians directly. They guide the money from about three dozen Jewish political action committees that are what they call stealth committees, because they don't have Israel or anything Jewish in their name, like Hudson Valley PAC or NatPAC, Northern Californians for Good Government, which is the one in the Bay Area. And they only give money to politicians outside of their congressional area. Now, who to give money to is more or less determined by the information they get from AIPAC. But AIPAC also sees to it that if you are a member of Congress, they might not give you money, but they will assure you that they will not support an opponent in an election if you do not speak out against Israel. Also, when you start to run for Congress, a staff member of AIPAC meets with you and asks you to make a statement on your position on Israel and the Middle East. Every member of Congress does that. Cynthia McKinney refused to do that.
And she's not in Congress anymore.
And then they publish that statement in their Near East report, which is a biweekly report that used to be on mailed to members of Congress. Now it's online, or they print it out for them. And so every member of AIPAC, as well as other members of the Jewish community around the country who support Israel, are aware of what a congressman's position is vis-a-vis Israel.
We're speaking with Jeffrey Blankfort. He does a show on KZYX up in Mendocino County. He is a seasoned, longtime journalist covering issues in the Middle East, Israel, Palestine, the long-term occupation of Palestine. Jeffrey has been in the middle of this for a long time. Now, just to sort of talk a little bit in the context of the Gaza war, we've seen Mitchell now. He's the man for Obama. I know that you've got some news for us. I guess Mitchell is now heading back from Israel to meet with, I guess, some of the old standard negotiators, which doesn't bode well for real change. And this happens at a time when, I guess, part of the Bush administration policy was to absolutely make it 100% impossible to pick up any threads of any peace talks before by slaughter that went on in Gaza.
Well, that was the intention of Israel. They don't take any chances. And this, whereas many people think this attack had to do with the Israeli elections, so Libni and Barak could show that they had some muscles, when it comes to foreign policy, the this is a unified position on the part of the Israeli government and all the people contending. They wanted to make sure that there were no pieces to easily pick up for Obama when he came in. Now, Mitchell went over there to listen. Of course, he did not go to Gaza to listen because, thanks to Israel, the United States is not allowed to talk, at least officially, with anyone from Hamas, just like in the past they weren't able to talk with anyone from the PLO. Mitchell is coming back tomorrow at 12:30. He's going to be meeting with people in Washington, both who will be from the administration and others, some old hands in Washington, some of whom are critical of Israeli policy, and will be asking Mitchell some hard questions. Whether this meeting is open to the press, I don't know, but it should be a very interesting meeting.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left.
Yeah.
So what is your take on Mitchell and the Obama situation? Now, we know about Rahm Emanuel. He is certainly not going to be pro-Palestinian, as they say. Give us your two-minute assessment.
I don't think the peace process, quote-unquote, is going anywhere. It was never designed to. It was designed to provide a cover for further Israeli expansion, dispossession of the Palestinians, taking more land, building more settlements. Israel just announced 2,500 new housing units near Efrat. This is a routine that they've done with every U.S. president, and the U.S. president at best says it's not helpful. Only George Bush I and Jim Baker, as Secretary of State, publicly criticized the settlements. They were the last to do so in that manner. I think this.
You said George Bush.
Nowhere.
You said George Bush.
George Bush Sr. Yes.
And James Baker,
the Secretary of State, publicly condemned Israel. Every time Baker went to the Middle East, Shamir built a new settlement. And both Bush and Shamir and Baker publicly criticized this. And if you go back and you'll see, they were called anti-Semitic, and George Bush got the lowest vote of any Republican in modern times.
Well, that's what
happened. They have cost in the election.
And I guess AIPAC is not gotten any weaker.
AIPAC is stronger than ever, despite several books written about it by one of Mearsheimer and Walt, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. I interviewed Mearsheimer the other day, and he said the Israel lobby is stronger than ever. They are funding, they're responsible, the lobby itself, not AIPAC itself, is responsible for about 60-70% of the Democrats' funding and about 25% of the Republicans. And that is significant.
Wow. All right. Jeffrey Blankfort, a longtime seasoned journalist covering the Middle East, does his own show on KZYX up north here, public radio station. And it's great to speak with you again, Jeff. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome, Dennis. Thanks to you. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. Take care. And let me just make this announcement, editorial announcement. I want to invite those of you with a poetic spirit to visit me on my new poetry blog. It's Joys of Poet J. That's J as the letter, joysofpoetj.blogspot.com. joysofpoetj.blogspot.com. Let's talk poetry on the blog. That does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Thanks.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, our technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Black Report contribute to this program. Our weekly Best of Flashpoints program producer is Amanda Bellerby. To comment on today's program, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. Look us up on the web at flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.